Hello, and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmosh, and this is our third and final episode in our series with Nick Greenfield, founder and board chair of microbiome analysis platform OneCodex. Again, I'd recommend listening to the previous two episodes to learn where OneCodex is now and how it got there. Today, however, we're talking about its future. All right, welcome back, Nick. This is going to be the last time we talked for now. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks, Dave.
So we've spoken about OneCodex's beginning, your beginning into this career style, the intermediates and all that. So naturally, what comes next is the future. So where do you anticipate OneCodex proceeding?
Well, so I think in the first episode, I described OneCodex as a microbiome company. And that's actually a relatively new framing for us, because for the longest time, we thought of ourselves as a microbiome analysis company. And principally, we had a software platform and product, and we were helping, you know, answer a question starting from a FASTQ, starting from A's and C's and G's and T's as bytes, right? Not as DNA or cells. You know, what's in these samples? What's going on? How do we reliably and reproducibly extract information? So the whole first chapter of OneCodex, very much an analysis and data company. That remains true, but now, you know, we're getting much more into integrated end-to-end offerings. And so being able to receive stool, receive cells, receive gDNA, produce data from those of very high quality, and I think perhaps a little bit uniquely in the market, do that and deliver the data in a really modern, efficient way. So deliver it via web platform, not, you know, an FTP site or a Google Drive link or something of this kind, deliver it with interactive analysis, kind of just improve that whole end-to-end experience. And then operationally, we have some things we've been focused on around, you know, reproducibility of extraction and how do we do batching? And how do you get the turnaround time to be a little bit faster than is conventional in the industry and just improve that product in general? But yeah, very much, I think we'll see more and more OneCodex's focus being supporting scientists, whether in an academic setting or in an industry setting, all the way from, you know, collected sequencing of collected samples, DNA extraction through to data analysis, instead of just starting kind of after the sequencer.
Right. So you're talking about investing into the physical requirements necessary to perform sequencing, everything from the instrument lab, to the kits, the reagents, the lab,
the quality, all of those things. And doing that in a first party way, as opposed to, you know, piecing together kind of partnerships with existing CROs or sequencing providers.
Right. And from a reproducibility standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. You now have a degree of control over how everything's done. And the only variable now is the sample that, you know, somebody had delivered to you.
Yep, exactly. And I think, you know, this will be appreciated by some in the audience, but for microbiome specifically, the DNA extraction is by far the largest source of error and variability. And so just being able to control that, using the same protocol, but beyond that, making sure that your inter-replicate differences are really low, using automation to the greatest degree possible, because a lot of those inter-replicate deltas otherwise are coming from kind of like hands issues and people doing things slightly different ways, makes a huge difference. And so I think, you know, we kind of got into sequencing by necessity, and that we didn't reliably see the data quality that we wanted across providers and across, you know, the things that would inevitably happen, where someone would use a different version of a kit or someone would implement the protocol slightly differently, even when you tried to control for these things. And so we kind of like, that's what drove us pushing upstream into having a full first party workload for that. And I think this stuff matters a lot less for certain classes of problems. It doesn't really matter if you're doing, I shouldn't say it doesn't matter, but it is much less difficult for, you know, bacterial isolate sequencing or human genomics and doing germline variant detection. It matters a lot for complex mixtures of cells, some of which are hard to lyse, some of which are easy to lyse, which are in a pretty nasty matrix, I think we can say, in the case of stool, and one that like needs to be stabilized. So yeah, that's, I think more and more we're gonna be kind of an end-to-end provider. We'll still have users who just interact with the platform after the sequencer, but I think we'd like to be there to support folks who have physical specimens where appropriate.
Great. I'm sure you're not leaving the software development behind either, though, are you?
No, not at all. We still consider ourselves a software and technology company. I think we maybe wouldn't put analysis as like the first and only word in the way where that was a really comfortable moniker before.
Mm-hmm. So
sequencing and analysis company.
There you go.
End-to-end microbiome company, whatever you want to say.
So that covers One Codex, but as chairman of the board, what does your future look like? What's Nick Greenfield's future?
Well, that's a big question.
we can keep it limited to the next half decade.
I thought you might ask this question, and I was like, well, I could prepare, but I actually don't know the answer. So that's kind of my answer. Right now, I'm spending my time helping the One Codex team with part of my time, and then working on kind of incubating a couple other ideas, doing some stuff around, gosh, it's so cliche to be doing things around AI right now, but doing some things around large language models. And
we can't get away from it.
Yeah. And specifically for data visualization, which is kind of a like side interest and passion of mine. So working on a project around data visualization and interfacing with that through natural language instead of through Matplotlib or R or, you know, Tableau. So we'll see. I think a couple other projects here and there, and see what sticks, both from an interest point of view and kind of a quality and what's possible to build point of view. But building some new things, keeping going with One Codex, helping that team and helping to grow that business, and then, you know, exploring some passions. That's the goal.
So this is going to be kind of a different question for the show in general, because I'm actually going to be plugging the Genome Portal right now. But okay. As you know, as we've been working together for the several years, ATCC is transitioning its Genome Portal into a supporting membership model.
Yep.
Right? Previously completely freely accessible, but now it's going to be, like I said, a supporting membership model. As a scientist, we all want everything to be free. I think we actually touched on this a little bit in the first episode. We love for things to be free. The reality is that to produce the high quality that we're looking for, it requires some extra investment. One Codex is vaguely in a similar frame. You've got your own self-styled database. You've got your own analytical tools that you've built. You've got all of these aspects to it, the web design and your for-profit company, actually, I assume. Yes, you're a for-profit company.
Which makes things a little bit easier in many ways, just in terms of where you put your R&D dollars and how you think about them.
Yeah. So ultimately, what I'm asking of you is, yeah, we've set our future now, and there's a little bit of like an internal conflict between the idealism of science and the reality of it. So how did you square that, and how do you feel about that as it moves into the upcoming future, especially like we've said a few times, there's only so much funding going around.
Yeah, totally. That's been like a big tension and challenge of One Codex from the earliest days. And I think, to be very forthright, I don't think we ever nailed it. And specifically what I mean is we wanted to support academic end users, but at some point their usage incurs real costs. We weren't set up as a foundation or a nonprofit to support that. And so we couldn't do kind of like unlimited free academic accounts. So we started in the early days of One Codex with, I guess, what you could consider a freemium model. You know, you get some amount of samples or analysis for free, and then you convert. And we were always more generous on the academic side, both in terms of those starting quotas, but also in terms of being willing to work with folks and, you know, figure out if we could do in-kind contribution to projects, things like this. It's always been a hard tension. Honestly, I don't think it really was the right solution for academics. We're actually going to be moving, experimenting with tweaking that model a little bit, and having it be a little bit more of a usage-based model in terms of the actual usage, in the sense of cloud and compute and RAM and things of this kind. And I think that's going to be a better balance, and we're going to try that out hopefully later this year and see if that's a better way to kind of serve the academic market, where the basic trade there is hey, we're going to solve a bunch of headaches and problems for you. It's going to cost some markup over doing it yourself on Amazon, but a modest and reasonable markup, especially when you factor in the fact that we're going to be really focused on only charging you for what you use. And if you do it yourself, you have to go, you know, manage all your compute yourself and make sure you never leave a server running, which is not easy to do, actually. to always avoid the extra bill is a very hard problem. And so, you know, I think that's where we're going to be going. But really, like, the motivation there is, I think it's always best to be in a position where you're selling something you would want to buy yourself. And, like, were I putting myself in academic shoes, I think there were cases where one codex, in the way things were structured historically, like, made sense. And I think we, you know, I believe in the product and we provide a lot of value. But I also, like, understand that it was not an easy, no-brainer decision. And we want to change that and make that simpler for academics and kind of more approachable. So I think, you know, you have to always balance, like, providing something that the customers want to buy the thing. If they don't want
to ultimately make something that somebody wants.
That's hard. You got to make something someone wants, but you know, depending on how you price it and how you position it, I think sometimes you're making a choice about kind of not selling to a market. And that's what we did for a long time in the academic market. We're hopefully going to be changing that and making the pricing and kind of the model a little bit more approachable for how folks on the academic side typically think about bioinformatics, which is not, you know, the project-based or value-based pricing that pharma might be a little bit more comfortable with.
Yeah, that's great. I know ATCC is very much dipping our toes into that and exploring those waters ourselves. And hoping we can skip right to the satisfying pricing model.
Well, we can explore this, like, offline, not on a podcast sometime in more detail, I'm sure. Podcast is probably not the right forum to, like, totally get into all the weeds. But yeah, I it's an interesting set of problems. Like, it costs money to produce high quality data. Ultimately, that has to be paid for somehow, you know, and it's either R&D dollars or it's part of a product line.
Right. That just is the nature of things. This is going to end up being a question for me, and it's probably going to be the last one that we've got time for. Are you familiar with the term taxonomic vandalism?
No. What is taxonomic vandalism? And should I know this term? Is this bad? Is this like a big blind spot?
I don't know if I'd call it a big blind spot, but...
Niche blind spot. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. A niche blind spot. I can send you a few links for it. The term is relatively new to me as well, but it's generally an effort to name species, genera, you know, whatever other ranks you choose, in rather quote unquote unscientific ways. And ultimately, there's, you know, regulatory agencies surrounding trying to limit this, what so-called unscrupulous behavior. Really, the language surrounding this is probably my favorite part, but. It ultimately brings me to the question, one codex maintains a database, a metagenomic database, Kamer-based database. How frequently does one codex update that? How do you intend to maintain that? I know how frequently you update it, but how do you intend to maintain this going forward as just taxonomy is constantly rearranging and it's constantly blooming and bursting into more and more different ranks and different classifications?
Yeah, that's a good question. So... this is something we've struck, like, you know, our cadences have shifted over the years, and at times we've been on quarterly cadences and at times more annual, and I think we're back to quarterly now, and that really just relates to, like, the curatorial problem is a hard one, and the infrastructure for doing that curation is itself kind of delicate and difficult to maintain. And so I think the intent is that we're going to continue curation at a high frequency. I'd love for that frequency to get lower. I think at the same time,
or even more straightforward, because data curation at this level is not simple.
Like, you can imagine continuous. Like, I think there is some value in versioning, right? Mm-hmm. And knowing, like, this is the answer as of this snapshot in time. We going back, you know, C. diff got renamed, right, to, I think, Peptoclostridium for a while. So it was P. diff. Like, well, that was fine for the taxonomists and, like, very, very confusing to clinical microbiologists, right?
Right.
So, I think, like, it's important. It's not good if all of a sudden one day you log in and it says PDIF when you were looking for CDIF. And so I think there's value in versioning and there's value in kind of snapshots and systems and of taxonomy. I think a similar tension that exists that we've kind of long struggled with is like around the time that, I mean, really before this, but I think GTDB, excuse me, if that's not coming through the enunciation on the audio here, really brought to the forefront is this idea of like a more data-driven taxonomy. You know, some of taxonomy is driven by biological distances in genomic terms, in genomic distances, some not so much because it's...
Some are just historical.
Yeah, exactly. And so GTDB did this work to kind of like re-architect taxonomy to be much more driven by those nucleotide deltas, basically. And for a long time, we thought like, is that the correct way to do things in some sense? And there's like algorithmically, I think there's some reasons why maybe that's the right tree structure. Like that's the most balanced tree you could build for certain types of classifiers that do certain things and, you know, how they deal with ambiguous calls and whatnot. But the reality is like people don't really like seeing, most people, most end users don't love seeing like, oh, this is like, you know, in the, I don't know, Prevotella, I'm making things up a little bit here, but like the Prevotella C group as opposed to the Prevotella A group, right? Like that's not a meaningful difference. That's an artifact of the taxonomic structure that something like GDB, and I'm not picking on GDB, any tool that's kind of purely data driven has. And so I think like that's going to continue to be a challenge over time is like, what are the right underlying data representations in terms of how to organize and store and curate and perhaps even do classification? Like, do you do metagenomics algorithmically in some, you know, a label-less, purely distance-driven world and on some structure that looks like that? Maybe it's a tree, maybe it's a graph, whatever, right? But then, like, how do you translate it back to names that mean things to people? Because it's important that the names mean things to people. And, you know, there's different audiences, and I think there's still, even that now that C. diff again, but, like, I think there are still many deltas also as you get into clinical practice where clinically different names are used or they have different significances or their rules of thumb where people say, oh, these are the same thing, you know, even though that's not how they'd be called by a taxonomist. Hard problem. I don't think doing it continuously is actually the right thing. So I don't think we'll probably ever do like constant live releases, but we kind of want to continue to work on improving cadence. And then I think that we're fairly strong believers that we should use whatever is the common system of representation in terms of labeling, and what's used under the hood maybe is not irrelevant or is transparent to the end user. But maybe it's something we'll support. You know, if you want to do it in GDB namespace, you can do that too.
I think having the best of both worlds typically the ideal approach, but in general, I think using common naming makes among the most sense because, and I might get some flack from taxonomists here, but taxonomy is not real, right? There are approximations based on human estimates and a desire to classify things for convenience. But, you know, whether you call it C. diff or P. diff, the cell in front of you is still what it was. And I can go on about Bacillus and Thrasis.
I'm not going to take a position on if taxonomy is real, but yeah, I mean, I think the important point is, if someone is looking for something and they know it by the name C. diff, and all of a sudden they can't find it, in an extreme case, well, you have a false negative for the user. Your taxonomy right. has introduced a false negative to the end user. And those are the kinds of things I think we want to be very mindful of and careful about.
But if nothing else, providing
times over the years, like inadvertently, I mean, there are far less well-known corner cases than C. diff becoming P. diff.
Oh, for sure. Even just trying to interrogate, you know, a mycoplasma contamination event, you've also got to consider the recently developed classification of mycoplasmopsis. And if you don't know, you might never notice.
Yeah.
So being aware of what your user's interests are, probably more inherently valuable.
And they're
very, being...
your users have different interests and they're going to disagree. And this is the hard part is like, you're not going to have the perfect system for everyone unless it's custom. And then who customizes it? Oh, that's a pretty big burden. Your users don't want to customize it. So
yeah, then they wouldn't be your users anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
What began in 2012 as a long shot in a competition has positioned itself as a major player in the field of metagenomics through a series of decisions that highlighted gaps in user experience, data quality concerns, and an acquisition and departing from another group. OneCodex is staying relevant by providing a straightforward service for a complicated process and steadily adding more to the portfolio, now including the procedures upstream of analysis, such as genomic material extraction and sequencing. Nick believes the standardization OneCodex is offering will be a long-term asset for the microbiome research community while he works on his own passion projects. This is going to close out our series of Nick Greenfield, founder and board member of OneCodex, a partner of ATCC and supporter of the ATCC Genome Portal. Make sure to look for the next series of Behind the Biology in the coming weeks.